Extracurricular in particular.
A podcast from Dr. Stan Chernikov.
Welcome back, scholars and their friends, to this episode of Extracurricular in particular. Today, I'd like to focus on two critical issues. One is central to everything college students do, and that is, how do they study effectively? How can they be successful in the classroom at exam time? Seems to be a critical thing for almost all students. The second principal issue is the other side of the coin. It deals with a concept that we refer to as resilience. What do we do when things don't go as planned? When a course just kills us, it beats us up, and we can't figure out how to succeed in it. So what do? Let's begin on the positive side and talk about how to study, where to study. And let's begin with the where. You, your parents, perhaps friends and family, perhaps the federal government, perhaps the local bank that offered you student loans, they're most likely paying a lot of money for you to attend a college or university. My question to you is, why not actually attend the whole college or university? Now, what do I mean by this? Most campuses have lots of wonderful buildings, but typically students only physically enter a small handful of those buildings during their entire college career. The ones that are occupied by the major the student selects and some of the other courses that they take along the way, but they avoid an enormous number of the campus buildings because they simply have no apparent reason to go in. I believe that you should go into every one of your campus buildings because they have special student lounges, special libraries, small libraries. They have cafes, and they have various other quiet study spaces. You might consider, if you're paying attention to what I'm suggesting, scouting for these places because fundamentally they're places to hide from your friends. Because when you're studying, you do not want the distraction of your buddies who are trying to get you to do something other than prepare for your exam. They're good friends. They love you. You love them. But they want to talk you into doing something other than your studying. So for you to be effective and productive, you need to find places on your campus where you can study. You may be thinking, well, I spent a lot of money to have a residence hall room or a room in a fraternity house or a sorority house or an apartment off campus. But you have to also realize you may have an annoying roommate. You may have noisy neighbors. So if you're considering your residence hall room, that might not be the very best place to study. Your apartment may have lots of loud distractions. The social whirlwind of a fraternity house or a sorority house can be very distracting. And even if you're living at home, your device-rich room, which is calling to you, come and play this game, come and listen to this music, is a distraction. So finding places on campus where you will not be distracted is really the essence of having the opportunity to study well. And I suggest to you, when you're doing this, that you change your pattern of study, that you pick different times and different places to study in the very same way that you have different kind of fitness workouts. So for example, you may do Pilates some days. You may do yoga some days. You may be lifting weights and doing cardio on other days. We tend to vary our workouts because if we don't, they become so damn boring that we burn out and we stop doing them. Same thing exists with studying and study spaces. If you keep going back to the same place, you might not study as effectively. If you have places all over campus where you do certain type of work, research for a paper or your quantitative math problem sets and things like that, some places might lend themselves better than others. So very much like a workout, you want to vary your spaces. You want to do it differently every day. But I have to encourage you to do something. You should try to study at least a little every single day. You should not be taking days off. You can study 20 minutes one day and 3 hours the next. But when you take a day off, it's kind of, again, like your fitness training and your workout schedule. If you take too many days off from your workout, it becomes progressively more difficult to get back to it. And the same is the case with studying. You get into a routine with your studying, you get into a routine with your workouts. So if you can mix things up, if you can mix in, let's say on a given day, you do a lot of the reading that you have assigned, you're feeling sharp, you're not falling asleep, and you say, I can do some of my reading today, then that would be a reading day. But there might be days where you're not feeling particularly sharp and you're not absorbing the information. That might be a day that you're doing a little bit of research for a paper that's coming up in a couple of weeks. And you might have days where you just say, I am thinking quantitatively today. I'm doing my chemistry homework. I'm doing my biology lab write-up. I'm doing my calculus assignment. Certain days lend themselves, certain moods lend themselves to different types of study. But again, don't take a long hiatus from your studies. Or when you're ready to get back to it, you may not be sharp. You may not be ready because you've taken too many days off. Now, I am absolutely sure you're going to think the next thing that I say is kind of insane. And I've done this before in these podcasts, so I accept that you're going to think that I'm being ridiculous on some level. But I believe you should actually be eager to study. When you think about it, what you are learning is going to ensure that you have a great career, a great profession, and a great life. Preparing to learn that information, enjoying the acquisition of that information, should be really part of why you're in college. So it's not the kind of thing that you're dreading. You're saying, damn it, I have to go and study now. I'd rather be watching Netflix, watching Prime TV, watching Apple Plus. There's so many things to distract you these days. But the reality is, those things can be watched at any time. Everything is on demand. So it's a nice situation for you that you're not missing anything. Things that you've recorded are available to watch later. Things on demand can be watched later. But studying is something that should be drawing you. And I know that sounds silly, because you probably have in the past not found it to be exciting, but realize you're building your career now, so keep this in mind. And one other thing, and this is important, and I've been making this case to students for 40 years. Stress is very unpleasant. Stress can really ruin a person's day, can ruin a person's year. If you study consistently, if you study not just the night before the exam, you will reduce your stress. Because frankly, there's nothing more stress reducing for a student than being well prepared for an exam. Being ill prepared for an exam drives you crazy and makes you miserable. But being prepared really reduces your stress. So please take this as a gift that I want to give you, because I know what stress can do to people. And if you study regularly and consistently, and in a great place on campus where your friends can't find you, you will be a far more successful student. And exam day will not be unpleasant. Take my word for it, please. Now that I've tried to make the point that you need to find a great place to study, we turn to the question of how to study. There are many, many wonderful books out there written by experts on educational method and theory that can teach you the very best strategies for effective study. I am not one of those experts. I'm a geologist. I'm not trying to be one of those people, but I really do want to invite you to find one of these books and review the techniques for effective study from an educational psychology perspective. These books may include the step-by-step suggestions of how to take effective notes, how to read a textbook very closely and effectively, and strategies to develop what every professor claims they want, and that they want their students to develop critical thinking and reasoning, and not just memorize a bunch of stuff for the test. So here are a few book examples. There's a book that's called The Secrets of College Success. It's written by a person named Lynn Jacobs, partnered with someone named Jeremy Hyman. And it's a very comprehensive look. It gives you 800 tips, techniques, strategies to help you figure out, among other things, What's going to be on next Thursday's test? You kind of figure out what the professor is going to ask. So The Secret of College Success by Jacobs and Hyman, a great purchase. I would suggest you consider it. Then there's something called Time Management Secrets for College Students. It's by a guy named Dennis Stemley. And it poses the question, are you the type of student who just can't seem to get everything done, to get organized enough, to get all of the work for all of their courses done and done well? This book could be the very best answer to your time management dilemma, which every student is dealing with every week. Then there's another book, and this is one I wholly endorse, called The Secrets of Top Students by a woman named Stephanie Wiseman. This book is written by a top student from Harvard, and as far as I'm concerned, it's a must for students who need to learn and relearn the very basics of advanced studentship. It covers everything. Covers what you should eat so that you're really sharp, how much to sleep, how to read a textbook, how to figure out what's on next week's test, and so very much more, written by a student who was an absolutely stellar student, and she's sharing with you her strategies. I wish I had this book when I was an undergraduate. So this is a book that I strongly recommend. These are the people who can help you figure out how to study most effectively. My suggestions here in this podcast deal with only one fundamental question in the how to study realm, and that is an individual choice. Do you study individually, alone, in whatever space you've identified, or do you study in a group with other students? You know yourself best, and you should be able to decide whether you prefer to study alone or if you prefer to study in groups. I would argue you should consider doing both. When you're alone, you concentrate better. You're not distracted. And you feel that less unpleasant stress, very common, of the intellectual competition that happens when you're talking to other students. You say to yourself, damn, she seems to know this a whole lot better than I do. I must be dumb. I'm screwed on this test. That's not a healthy attitude. But if you're studying alone, you don't have to deal with this. You go at your own natural pace. And that's a very comfortable thing to be able to do. So if you're going at your own pace, you can take breaks when you need to. You don't have to deal with anyone else's concerns or personality. On the other hand, everyone absorbs and understands and masters course content differently. And it's a real advantage to be able to learn from other students. They may understand something that you don't understand. You may understand completely something that's a total mystery to them. And consider, there are days where you go to class, you got a cold, you got the flu, or you're just tired from whatever happened the night before, and you take a brief nap. Well, what if you take a brief nap and an important concept passes right by, never appears in your notes, and it makes up 20% of the next exam? When you study in a group, you're able to interact with one another and find out the gaps in what happened to you in your class and in your note-taking. So this is a really good reason to do this, is to exchange notes with other students. What I am encouraging you to do at this point, and you may reject this, is to consider a hybrid model here, where you study alone part of the time and you study in groups at other times. What I suggest is, when you are preparing for, let's say, a big exam, you review everything that you have in your notes and in your readings. You have to review it thoroughly so that you understand where gaps may be in your understanding and in your note-taking. Please, at this point, be honest with yourself, because if there's a giant gap in what you see in your class notes, then there's a great likelihood that somebody else has captured that information. Hoping that that will not be on the test is an absolute certainty that it'll be the first major question on the test, because you'll hear this time and time again when you're in college. Hope is not a strategy. You want strategies for success? Hoping that something that you're not prepared for will not be on the test is a surefire way to not succeed. So realize that's not the way that you want to succeed here. After you've done a thorough review of everything that you've studied and the notes that you've taken and the flashcards that you've prepared from the textbook, at that point, it's the ideal time to begin to study with your classmates, to fill in your gaps, to help them fill in their gaps. And as a saying goes, you never really understand a concept as thoroughly as you could than when you have to teach it to somebody else. You may think you understand something, and then somebody says, well, I don't understand it. Explain it to me. And at that point, you're confronted with the reality that you don't understand it quite as much as you thought. What you want to be sure to do during the course of studying in any circumstance is to fill in the gaps before exam time. Of course, if you're studying alone and thoroughly and reviewing everything, and then meeting with a study group to fill gaps for one another, you may end up studying more than you anticipated. You may end up spending more time in study. But that really brings you back to the whole issue of time management. It's always the key is to making sure that you have enough time in your day and you're not wasting the day. So part of the day could be spent in individual study. Part of the day could be spent in group study. But as I said to you earlier, you will be guaranteeing by this combination, this hybrid of individual and group study, that you will feel far less stress when the exam comes around, because there will be no gaps in your understanding. You've either filled them in yourself or others have helped you to fill them in. And you will applaud the fact that your soaring grades will confirm that this hybrid strategy of personal and group study really does indeed work. But then there's the issue of what you know and what your friends know. And sometimes you don't have everything covered. The very best scholars are the ones who take advantage of every available learning resource that they know of to make sure that everything is clear before exam time. They leave absolutely nothing to chance. So they visit the departmental study center where perhaps senior undergraduates and graduate students are available to answer your questions. They go directly to the source. They go to the professor's office hours, which I've been preaching to you for quite a while now. And at that point, you can ask the professor directly, could you clarify this for me? Can you explain this to me? Can you give me another analogy for that? Of course, pay attention now. If you don't start studying until the night before, or even worse, the morning of the big exam, you can never go to the departmental study center. You can never go to your TA if you have one. You can never go to the professor's office hours because time has run out. That's why I'm always encouraging you, study a little every day. Learn where the gaps are in your notes and in your understanding. And then you go to see your TA, you go to see your professor, or you go to the departmental study center. That's what a wise student will do. And I am driven to hope that you will be that kind of wise student. One very final note about studying. This is your education. It's not your friend's education. It's your education. You may adore your friends, but from a study standpoint, they may actually be your worst enemy. They may try to persuade you to hang out tonight, to play video games, to watch a movie with them, to party nonstop, even on the night before an exam. Maybe they don't have an exam tomorrow, but you do. It is in your very best interest to learn to resist their pleas to do something other than the studying you know you need to do. That's why you search for those private, out-of-the-way places on campus where they can't find you, and you guard those locations tenaciously. You need to be thoughtful and very selective about who you're assembling into your study groups. You want to study with people who share your commitment to excellence, to advanced scholarship, the people who study most productively. And realize how symbiotic study groups are. You help them to understand things and prepare for the exam, and they help you. They don't seek to distract you. They don't try to convince you to avoid studying. That's the job of your wild and crazy fun time friends and it's great that you have them, but not at exam time. So if possible, keep these two groups apart. Keep your party friends in one group and your study friends in another group. And that's the best advice I can give you about trying to be effective in your studying. And now a quick pivot. You find the right places to study. You find the right study group to work with. You study hard, you study as best you can, but somehow the results do not match your efforts. What do you do when things don't go as planned? What do you do when you came to college to be a major in business or in electrical engineering or computer science or pre-med, but you have to realize most of those campuses these days, those hyper-popular majors are very competitive, and you need stellar grades in every one of those so-called weeding out classes, those intentionally challenging gateways to a major that stymie certain people as they're going towards their goals. Try as you may, try as you might, your grades simply fall perhaps just a little bit short of your goals. It happens to all of us from time to time. You are not alone in this. But how then do you respond? First, you have to realize, and I know this is a cliche, it's not the end of the world. If you are a wise, scholarly student, you will always be able to find great options, some of them good, some of them even better than your original goals, but you have to know how to find those. So this, my friend, is an exercise in something referred to as resilience. How do we take a less than optimal situation, come out the other side of it even stronger, even more determined than ever? Another way of saying this is, and this is a popular expression these days, how does one fail forward? We all fail. Accept that. That's part of life. But how do you fail and lean into it in a way that will make you successful on the other side? You take a difficult setback. You assess your options. You seek advice. You don't try to do it on your own. And then you plot a new course, possibly even better than the original course. A wise scholar doesn't try to do it by themselves. They immediately go around campus, find a departmental advisor, find a general advisor to learn about their other options. So for example, you wanted to be a computer scientist. There are 1,000 spots in your department on campus for computer science majors. There are 5,000 students who want to be a computer science major. Some people are not going to make it. If that doesn't work out for you, where do you turn next? Typically, a campus advisor will be able to help you figure this out. So for example, many campuses have what's known as an informatics program. This is a much more applied and practical way of doing computer science, and it almost guarantees you a post-graduation job. Perhaps it's somewhat easier to enter the informatics program than the straight computer science program, and an advisor can help you figure out how to get there. What if your plan from day one has always been to be a business major? And again, there might be spaces for 2,000 students on campus, but 9,000 students want to be business majors. 7,000 students will not get their first choice under those circumstances. Lots of times people pivot. They pivot, let's say, to economics, or they go to an advisor and they get the guidance that indicates that, in truth, having an undergraduate major in business may not be as powerful as having an MBA, a master in business administration. In many ways, there are ways to go to get a graduate degree in business, very valuable in the job market, by being a major in English or in history or in chemistry. You don't have to major in business to have a spectacular career in business. And in truth, graduate programs who want to bring you in and pay for your education are very excited about students who demonstrate resilience, who demonstrate that when they have to figure out a new and creative pathway, they're able to do it and they're able to succeed. It is never the end of the world, all of us have gone through it, but realize you need assistance in this regard, so campus advisors can certainly help you. And then there's the ultimate student struggle, a real crappy situation, a course that you simply can't seem to master no matter what you do. Try as you may, the concepts don't register with you, and all of the thoughtful study strategies in the world continue to fail to unlock the mystery of that particular course. What do you do when you're confronted with this type of dilemma? We all have reached this point in a class. I know that I have, so I imagine some of you will experience this. Again, a key is to seek out advice from a campus advisor. They should be your first stop in this. But ultimately, you will learn that virtually every college campus has a built-in solution to this challenge. Drop the class. You don't have to have it. You don't have to finish that class. Almost every college campus has a mechanism for dropping a class. And again, it's not the end of the world. Perhaps you just switch the class to a kind of credit, no credit grading, or a pass-fail type of grading, in which case you just have to get a minimal grade in order to get the credit. But sometimes you can't even do that. And I've experienced this myself. You may view this as a personal failure. I can't encourage you enough to not feel that way. This is an opportunity to learn from a setback. That's the key to resilience. But you need to ask yourself some questions. Should I have registered for this course in the first place? Did I have all the prerequisites to succeed in this course? Did you do what I have suggested in the past? Did you investigate the teaching style of the professor in advance so that you know that this is the kind of person you would learn from effectively? You'll have to answer this question on your own. Did you study enough? Did you study productively enough in order to succeed in that class? But then there are some practical things you need to address. How will you then adjust your academic plan to account for the potential loss of those credits? You're falling a little bit behind if you don't have that class. And how will that affect your financial aid if you receive it, or your scholarships if you have one? Again, I can't emphasize enough, advisors are there to advise and guide you on this. Please take the fullest advantage of this vast knowledge of the university on the part of your advisors and their eagerness to help you navigate through these inevitable potholes. You go through college life, there will be low spots, courses that really confound you. And how you respond to that, how you are resilient, will determine what your next step is and how you can get back on board with complete success in your studies. That being said, kind of briefly today, I'd like to move to our guest. And I'll introduce our guest in a few moments, but our guest is a person who has a certain level of expertise in the area of advising students, resilience of students, and just the total support of the whole student. And this person is a person named Ed Taylor, and we'll be chatting with him in a few moments. Well, our guest today is Dr. Ed Taylor, who I've known since basically he's a child, and it's wonderful to see him. He is the Dean and Vice Provost that oversees so much of what we've been discussing over the first 6 weeks of this podcast. It's his world that is the world that I really want you to aggressively enter when you have the opportunity and seek out all of the things that Ed can share with you. But before we go into all of those various things, rather than me singing his praises, which would be very easy for me to do, I'd like him to tell a little bit of his personal backstory. And this is the ongoing theme. Ed is a professor in the School of Education. Ed is now a dean. He's now a vice provost, but he's easily one of the most approachable people on a college campus that I've dealt with. He adores having students knock on his door. He wants people to be in contact with him. And I've been preaching to all of you who've been listening to this podcast that you shouldn't limit yourself from going into chat with a college president, going into chat with a dean, when there's something that you are curious about or something you're concerned with. So if Ed would be so kind, I'd like him to share with you so that you know he's a real guy and not just some administrator, that he tells you a little bit about where he was born and raised, and perhaps a little bit about him playing a little bit of Gonzaga basketball. So I leave it to Ed to tell a little bit of his own personal story so that you know a little about him before we go into the nuts and bolts.
Stan, first of all, I just have to say what an honor it is to be in the presence of one of the most talented educators and leaders that I've ever encountered in all my time in universities. So, Stan, you know this. I'm from a town in Central California called Lompoc, California.
Know it well.
New York City, where my family had grown up. I had an uncle who was a priest in Harlem, and my father grew up in New York and New Jersey, and my mother grew up there. And, you know, my father did something that wasn't uncommon for a lot of fathers back in the 1960s and 1970s. It was not easy being a Black man in the United States at that time. And so it was a confusing time for Black men. It was a challenging time. And so he decided he didn't want to be in a family anymore. He wanted to do something else. And a lot of fathers said they were going off to war in my neighborhood. And they were kind of going off to do something war related, but they were changing their lives. They were leaving. And so my family moved out to Lompoc, working class community. There were about 12,000 kids in that community at the time, farm community. And we'd go to school and all of us would talk about the fact that our fathers went off to war. And we don't know where they really went, but we were raised by moms. We were raised by our mothers. And we would go out during a day. And that was back in the day when you'd go out to play, you'd walk to school and walk back home from school. And on Saturdays, if you had a basketball and some tennis shoes, you'd go out with a ball and just play all day. And I mean, all day, play from 8 o'clock in the morning and come back and when the sun set and just find a court and just find ways to be creative and play. I went to high school in Lompoc, not knowing that there are really different kinds of schools for different types of people. So I went to Lompoc High School and I didn't know to question that we were taking woodshop a couple of times and a class called foods a couple of times and classes on healthy living and occasional other classes, like a civics class where my teacher played the guitar for us and played Grateful Dead songs. And I thought that's what classes are supposed to be. And, you know, over the years of just taking my ball and playing outside and learning how to shoot in California wind, I actually started getting better and I grew to be about 6'5" and college coaches would write letters to me. And I remember going to one of my math teachers and I said, gosh, I'm getting these letters. I may end up going to college. And so I actually think I should do some more math. And I distinctly remember my math teacher saying, you know, Eddie, I'm a wrestling coach at first and I do math and you know as much math as I do. So if you know seventh grade math, that's what I know. And if you know eighth grade math, and I thought I'm in trouble here, but I've done as much as I can do at Lompoc High School. So lo and behold, a coach from Gonzaga University came to visit me in my hometown because he heard I was pretty good. And he asked me to play on an outdoor court to basically try out, to bring some guys together and do a tryout. And so we played outside at the high school on an outdoor court with an old rubber ball. And I had a decent day. And we played for a few hours and he sat in the chair and he watched. And then he invited me to Spokane. And for what was essentially a tryout, what coaches used to do then was invite you to come and have a pickup game with guys. And if you played well, they'll come down and offer you a scholarship. If not, they'll send you home, maybe with a bus ticket. And so I had a good day on a Saturday afternoon and the coach came down from out of an office and said, we want to offer you a scholarship. And I said, sure. So that was my ticket to Gonzaga. The striking part and the crisis for me came my first year at Gonzaga when I was handed a stack of books, a statistics book, an ethics book, a theology book, biology book, and I had 20 some credits and realized there was a book in particular that got me. It was called Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Letters and Papers from Prison. It was a theology book. And I sat down in my room and I made the mistake that a first generation student shouldn't make. I arranged to get a room by myself so I could suffer quietly. And I would sit and I would try to read this book and realize, I realized my first semester, Stan, that as I was holding this book and the other books, that throughout the course of my high school, I was never assigned a book to read. Not a single book. This is the first book that I'd ever actually held and was asked to read. And I didn't know how to read it. It wasn't that I couldn't read. I just didn't know how to read a text. And that's when I started thinking about different types of education, because I was in a class with 15 students that came from Bellarmine Prep, Gonzaga Prep, Seattle Prep, and they had all been prepped. And that's when I started realizing that there are things called working class schools, where you're meant to go through them and go to work. And there are prep schools where kids are prepared to go to college. And I was on a path that was designed to send me to work. It's not a bad thing. Work is not a bad thing. But it's something called the hidden curriculum. And once I discovered that, I thought, now I've got to find a way to close this gap between myself and these students that I don't know if they were any more brilliant. They were just prepped for college. So I spent my time at Gonzaga working really hard to play against really good players, but working really hard to belong. I had a stats professor who called me in and said something that I found insulting at the time, but it was liberating. I failed her class the first semester. A semester is a long time to be in a class with a stats professor. I like the quarter system. A semester is a long time. These faculty get to know you. And I had to go see her weekly. And at one point she looked at me, her name was Elizabeth Cole. She looked at me and she said, you've got a problem here. And your problem is not statistics, it's mathematics. You don't know math. And I was insulted by that, but she was right. And she said, the second problem that you have is you have to figure out why you're here, because you come here in basketball sweats and you act like a basketball player and you have to decide whether you want to be a student. And you just have to figure that out. And I was insulted on both of those things, but she was right on both of them, because I needed to spend a lot of time with her studying math and statistics. So I spent the whole year with her and I had to figure out whether I wanted to be a student and an athlete. And so while she insulted me, she inspired me. And there's more to that story, because she ended up being a lifelong friend. So that's how I got to Gonzaga. And that was a dilemma for me at the time that I had to find a way to reconcile.
There's a story that you once told me having to do with your first, I think it was your first Christmas.
Yeah.
could you share a word or two about that? Resonated with me.
Thank you for asking that, Stan, because this is the time of the year. I actually get emotional thinking about this, because this is the time of the year, because I'm sitting in my office at University of Washington. I'm in Seattle and it's dark. And, you know, December is, you know, the finals is coming up and semester schools, kids are at home for the holidays, and quarter schools, kids go home. And if you're on a basketball team, and my first year coach scheduled practice December 23rd, the morning of the 24th and the afternoon of the 26th in Spokane, Washington. And there were some local players. And so everybody by this time at Gonzaga's campus has gone home. There's 4 feet of snow and most people on campus are gone. So they closed down some dorms. And I went to practice one morning in middle of December and came back to my dorm in my sweats and my tennis shoes with a ball. And I went to open my dorm and it was locked. And it was evening, about this time of the evening. And I went to another dorm and it was locked. And my teammates they'd all gone home. And what I did before that happened, Stan, I told my mother that on college campuses that kids all stay there. It's a big festive, they do a holiday party there and it's a lovely thing. And I said, Mom, you know, if you don't mind, I'd like to stay with all my people at on campus. And she goes, if you're sure, you know, I don't want to take you from all of the fun. What I was really saying was I didn't want her to pay. She couldn't afford to pay to get me home for a day and back. So the kids that were local went home. And I didn't realize that when the last person left campus at Gonzaga, they turned the lights off and locked the doors and went home. So I had to find a place to stay as it got dark and I had sweats on. So I roamed around and there was a house on campus. They call it campus house, where some students live that were doing service related things. And they were gone. So I jimmied the window of the house and I climbed in this dark house. And there was a couple of logs of fire. So I learned how to make a fire in the house. And I sat there and I sat in a chair thinking, okay, so I'm one of seven Black men at Gonzaga. And I've just entered into a house. And I don't know if these people are coming back or not. But I sat there in front of the fire the first night and burned all the wood that they had. And I had to go out and get some more wood. And, you know, through the night, I'd have to go out and get more wood and burn what I could. And the place to get wood is in people's backyards because they have those little things by their garage where they stack their wood and they keep it dry. So I dispersed my energies. I'd go to different houses and make sure I wasn't taking wood from the same house. And this went on for what seemed like an eternity. And I woke up one morning really early, like 6:37, to go get some wood because I was freezing. And was gathering up some wood and had wood in my arms. I looked in the backyard of this house, this little Spokane craftsman house, probably like yours. And I know this is family. There's a father with what looked like a bathrobe on and a mom, and they were hugging each other. And the kids were tearing open Christmas gifts. And there was a fire going. And I realized it's Christmas morning. I'd lost track of time. And I started, and I'm 18 years old, 17 or 18. And I just started crying. And my tears were freezing as I was crying. And so I dropped the wood, ran back to the house, called my mother, Collect, and said, and I had the presence of mind to put Christmas music on the radio. And I said, Mom, we're all having a, you know, Merry Christmas. We're all having a good time. And I hope you're having a good time and everything is fine here. And she said, you sure? And I said, yeah, listen to the music. We're having a great time. Everybody's here. And I hung up and I sat down in this chair in front of a now an empty fireplace and just wept. And I thought, you know, I hate this. I hate where I am. I hate what I've become. Here I am stealing from people's backyard on Christmas. So I sat there and I thought, what have you done? I told everybody on campus I was going home. I told my mother I was celebrating. So I sat there and late in the day, the door opens up and some guy walks in, big guy, 6'7", silver haired guy. And he looked at me and he goes, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm waiting for a cab because I'm going home. And he said, Christmas Day? And I said, yeah. He said, what time's the cab coming? I said, oh, in an hour. So he goes back in the house and he picks up some gifts that he had stored at the house and he starts to walk out and he sits in his car out in front of the house. And I looked out the curtain and I'm looking at him and he's sitting there looking at me. And we stared at each other for about 2 minutes and then he drove off. And he didn't come back. And I was worried that he was going to go with the police or something, because clearly I didn't belong there. So jump ahead a couple of weeks, students are coming back to campus. And this student approaches me, her name is Mary. And Mary says, I have a question for you. Were you in my house during Christmas? And I said, perhaps. I said, why do you ask? And she said, my dad, she said, that's my house. And I lived with a bunch of other students. And my dad came, and her dad is named Stan Fairhurst. Her dad would come to campus on Christmas Day to give donuts to anybody who was left on campus, to any of the staff on Christmas morning. And he would roam around campus, but he'd also store gifts in the house. And she said, my dad came home and came back to the Christmas table and was sitting at dinner, bawling his eyes out, and something about a man, a student in the house alone. And she said, it almost ruined our Christmas. It was like a Christmas story about somebody being alone. She goes, well, was that you? And I said, yeah, it was. She said, well, my dad wept all through dinner. And Stan Fairhurst was an administrator. He was a financial aid guy. And from that point on, Stan never mentioned that event, never mentioned seeing me, but he made a point of inviting me to Easter at his home and then Thanksgiving and then Christmas. So for the next 4 years, for the rest of my time there, I spent holidays with the Fairhurst family. They never mention it. Mary Fairhurst went on to become Chief Justice Fairhurst, lived in Olympia, became our state Supreme Court. Mary died last year. And I wrote an article in the Seattle Times about her family because I became part of the family. And I told the story of Stan finding me in that house. Stan died about 8 years ago. I went to his memorial, and I went to Mary's last year, and I sat with the family and wrote a story about being part of the Fairhurst family and about being found in that house. And when I got married 30 years ago, I was standing at the altar, and I looked up from the altar, and Stan Fairhurst walked in with his wife, Mary, and they stood in the back and gave me a blender for my wedding and then left. And it was the kind of relationship that actually changed my life, Stan. And it was the kind of educator that you've been and that we all aspire to be.
I don't know where to go with that story other than to thank you for sharing it. I've been preaching at the students that they should not be attempting to go it alone when they come to a college campus.
Yep.
And that they should seek out a Stan Fairhurst for themselves. I never know when I speak out into the ether whether anyone's paying close attention to this, but I think your story dramatizes the possibilities that exist on a college campus to build relationships that you don't know will be relationships that last a lifetime.
Absolutely.
You know, and we've shared students over the years who were in their lives for better or worse, I think for the large part better. And it, you know, sad when we get to my age, for example, that I have to anticipate that there's someday going to be a memorial for me. And there's going to be a whole bunch of these students are going to be there. I unfortunately won't get a chance to see them, but it will be really the culmination of what has been a long life of service to these students. But our listeners have to understand that we can't force them to be part of our lives, that they have to seek us out to become part of our lives.
Right. And Stan, it goes both ways. And one of the things that you've modeled during your career, students need to seek out faculty. And faculty, by virtue of choosing to be at a university, need to seek out and see their students as really interesting human beings worth being in a conversation with. One of our colleagues, Sean Wong, talks about it in much the way that you've modeled, Stan, that you start a conversation with students that goes on for the rest of our lives. And right. It's a conversation that just carries on. It doesn't end at the end of a quarter or the end of a semester. It carries on. And so you see them come back with their children. You show up at their weddings and you see them grow up over time. And eventually perhaps they'll replace us, but it's a conversation that just carries on. And until it doesn't.
Right.
It's a lovely thing.
So you occupy a post at the university where you oversee a lot of what our undergraduates need and should consider, such as advising and other types of programs. Could you talk a little bit about the kinds of things that you oversee in your very extensive portfolio that our listeners would then understand that you're a guy who they should have in their lives
yeah.
to the degree that they're willing to do?
Stan, the first thing that really begins the year for students that are coming to campus, whether they're first-year students, whether they're transfer students, whether they're graduate students. I was a graduate student when you started this. When I first enrolled at the University of Washington as a grad student back in the 90s, my first year I came to campus and I got my books and I walked around and it felt dreary. It felt frightening. I took my books in the Miller Hall and I started classes. And it felt big and vacuous and kind of ominous. And you started something the next year. I walked across campus with my books, and I'll never forget the day I walked into Red Square and there was a band called Mock Tube that was playing, and they were jamming, and there were hundreds of people on Red Square. And people were dancing, there were clubs and organizations, the place was lit up. And I had my books and I thought, let me set my books down and listen to Mock Tube, because there's this dude up there with the big afro. Mm-hmm. And people were just, and there was coffee and there was donuts and people were celebrating. And I thought, the difference between last year and this year, and I saw you walking across Red Square and I said, where did this come from? And you said, I started something called Dog Days. We're going to start the year differently. We're going to start the year celebratory. And from that point on, I realized how you welcome people into the campus. And it did something really powerful, Stan, which was the campus became the center. Not that the community is a problem, but rather than going out to their respective homes and going off campus, where all kinds of problems happen for students in their first year, students were coming to the center of campus and being together and connecting with each other. And that Dog Days went over the course of the day and into the night and into the first several days, which meant welcoming students into a community and connecting them. And connecting them to freshman interest groups, connecting them to each other, connecting them to a campus that sent a message that we care about you, that you shouldn't just carry your books and go to class and be anxious, that you ought to come into a community that's celebratory. We moved from that. And so, Stan, you started Dog Days and that, and then they enter into a program that, you know, yes, we have advisors in the first year experience because we want students to connect. You know this about advisors, that our advisors are people that that see themselves as educators. They're not just in a transactional relationship, take this class, take that class. They want to be a part of your journey. So many of the advisors in my unit in Mary Gates Hall have PhDs. They've chosen not to be teachers. They've chosen to be advisors, and they've chosen to be on the journey. And I kind of think of it as if you're crossing a river and you're trying to figure out where to put your feet. Advisors are putting rocks down and say, just step here and step there. Now, wade in a little bit and just sort of go a little further out and figure out how to get to the other side. And there's kind of swimming behind you as you go and placing rocks ahead of you. And these are people that are very much committed to the well-being of individual students. And many of them have been here now 15, 20, 25 years. This is what they do as part of their profession. Thousands of students come through and they link up with faculty and guide them through until the end. It's really a lovely thing. And so students need to find a way to their advisors. And it's like stepping on a rock and just standing for a moment and figuring out where to go next until they wade all the way through. And they get handed on to the next person and the next person and the next person. Right. So some of that happens, Stan, in that very first year are things that you started realizing that in that first year, when I think about my first year on campus, rather than being in a house trying to find wood, it's connecting students to community, especially on big campuses. There's nothing more important in that first year than connecting with people who care about you. Right. So thank you for starting those. And that's all part of, you know, I oversee a unit that has any number of programs that are aimed at the first year experience, connecting students to each other, connecting students to their faculty, connecting students to their advisors. So there isn't a sense of being alone in this journey.
Can you talk a little bit about the Resilience Project?
Yeah.
Because I've been, you know, I can preach all day about you can do this and be successful and you can do that and be successful. And each of us, you know, you banged up against when you first arrived at Gonzaga, your deficiencies in mathematics and how that was going to affect you on the long term. All of us have deficiencies. All of us have strengths. All of us have weaknesses. And sometimes things do not go according to our ideal plan. How do you, in representing the university, view what students go through when they are confronted with the need to be resilient, to pivot from what was their lifelong dream of being a business major or in computer science or a mechanical engineer, and it just doesn't seem to get traction. So they need to rethink and adjust. And the Resilience Project, which I think is a brilliant idea, because all of us need to be resilient and we need to learn to fail forward.
Absolutely.
Could you talk a little bit about that for a moment, please?
And I want to go so far as to actually say that that some universities are making a mistake, and they're part of the problem. And here's the mistake that we can easily make. There are some schools historically, the Ivy League schools and such, that serve a small percentage of the population and an elite portion of the population, and they're meant to represent excellence. And that's a tiny, tiny portion of the population that go to Harvard and Yale. But those of us that are public institutions or land grant institutions, our purpose is to serve a broad range of people. a broad range of students. And they may be military veterans, they may be first generation students, they may be multi-generation Huskies, they may be student athletes. But to serve the general populace and educate a wide range of people to support this democracy that we believe in. So in some ways, there are universities that begin acting like private schools and take great credit for having almost perfect GPAs or students that look perfect or students that have piled on their resumes and have tried to be perfect. And they've done things that are almost unnatural to become applicants that almost look perfect. And so when they get here, the level of stress and anxiety among our students is beyond our capacity to even serve them in regular counseling offices. And I think part of that is because we've said, to get into these universities, you better be a 3.9 or a 3.99. And students are picking up on that and saying, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to be perfect, I've got to create a food shelter in Haiti, I've got to do all of these things, I've got to be perfect. Well, and when they get here and they have their first experience of getting a B, we see students fall apart. Or they're stressed because they don't get into their major and they don't get what they need because they've been told that they have to be perfect. So what we've done is actually invite students to just embrace that first failure, to actually learn how to fail, to experience failure, and know that from here on, a good part of your life is stumbling. And the question is, how do you get back up? Not do you stumble or not, but we want students to stumble. We actually want high school students to try things and not be perfect and to stumble. So we created Fail Forward, my colleague Ann Browning and I and others. And we started actually with asking leaders on campus, asking our best scholars, our campus leaders, our presidents, our deans, and others to not stand up and say, look at me, I went to Yale, I'm a preeminent scholar, I'm a preeminent writer. We asked them to not do that, but to actually go back to when they were 17 and 18. And when they didn't know what they were doing, and when they failed along the way, when they failed their math classes or they failed a writing class, and tell that story so that students can know that we are resilient people. And so most of our faculty and Stan, we would love to have you in a Fail Forward, because you'd probably tell stories of ways in which the journey has been tumultuous. And we have to be honest about that. So many of our faculty, although they posture as though they're brilliant, they didn't wake up brilliant. They didn't wake up as successful faculty. They didn't wake up as tenured. They didn't wake up as professor. The journey along the way has been interesting and tumultuous. But what we did was we skinned our knee and we got back up and we kept moving. So the lesson to students is, you're going to fall. And in fact, you should fall. And we've got some faculty who are going to say, if you haven't fallen, we're going to help you fall. If you're an athlete, you're actually going to lose some games, and things are going to happen along the way, and you got to get back up. And part of what we're also messaging to them, Stan, when you get into adulthood and you get a little gray in your hair, well, you look back and you think, I'm sure glad I was prepared to deal with loss. I'm sure glad I was prepared to deal with a little bit of failure along the way, because adult life becomes a whole lot of that. It's about being smart, and yeah, it's about doing well at stuff. But it sure is about failing in relationships and learning how to make it back up again. Being married is about figuring out how to work through challenges and problems. Being a parent, being an employee, all of those things. So it's preparation for that. So we are actually embracing that this notion of failing forward and inviting and creating a college campus is a pretty safe place to actually experiment with trying things that you can't do. The last thing we want is students to come through and say, I better take courses that help me get a 4.0. What drives faculty more crazy, Stan, than students that worry about their grades?
Guardians of their GPA.
Or their GPA, and they negotiate to try to get that 4.0, and that's their job here. Most faculty would say, absolutely not. So we want students to fail. We want to create circumstances in which they take risks and stretch themselves and go, oops, that didn't work. Right. And to model the kinds of things that make for adult life, really.
It's interesting you point this out, because in the first episode of this podcast, now we're in number 6, I admit, somewhat uncomfortably, that this is an exercise in hypocrisy to some degree, because I was the antithesis of what I'm proposing that they do. I mean, I was a horrifically poor undergraduate student who did nothing out of the ordinary or to make myself a special student. I was not mature enough to understand any of that. And I benefited from faculty who guided me into a more beneficial position, but it took quite a while. I was a tough nut to deal with. Can students come and see you whenever they wish? I know that in your position, there are so many students at a place like the University of Washington that you would be overwhelmed if everyone said, I think I'm going to go talk to the dean of undergraduate academic affairs. But I can't imagine you've ever turned away a student who came to you with a concern or came to you with a proposal, a great idea that they'd been germinating. Can students come and see you? Because I've been proposing to them to be the kind of student who wants to have access to the leaders on campus and to the thought influencers on campus.
Stan, I've tried to model this after you a little bit. And I've offered this to students here at the university and the students in high schools and students in middle school. My favorite was a student, Miss Dahlia, in a middle school in Othello, Washington, Eastern Washington. And I was talking at a conference, a school conference of middle school kids. And I was on a panel of business leaders, and she put her hand up. She was 12 or 13 at the time. And she asked this incredible question. She said, can you all, panel, tell me how to get from where I am, subtext poor, Latino, public school, living modestly, to where you are? And here I was sitting on a panel, and the microphone got handed to this business leader who looked for a second and paused, and it handed it to the superintendent who was sitting next to me and looked and paused and didn't say anything and then handed it to me. And I remember saying something, and I thought, you know, the least we can do is answer this question. And I said something really stupid. I said, you know, I was quoting Whitney Houston, you have to believe that you can fly and what you believe mm-hmm. you can be and all this garbage. And then after the panel was over, I went up to her and I said, first of all, I'm ashamed of my colleagues who didn't answer the question. I said I was terribly inarticulate. And I gave her my card and I said, here's my email, I want you to write me. And let's stay in touch. And you know, when you do that with students, sometimes they'll take you up and sometimes they won't. So she wrote to me, and she wrote to me once a month for the next 10 years. She wrote to me that she finished junior high school and she went to high school. She wrote to me that she got her driver's license. She wrote to me that she was about to graduate from high school and invited me to her high school graduation. She wrote to me that she got college acceptance letters. And to my chagrin, she said, I'm going to WSU. She wanted to stay close to me. And so I said, I forgive you for that.
What can you do?
Then she wrote me a note that her first year at WSU, that she was going to go home. That she was tired and she was going to go home. So I wrote her a 4-page email and telling her my story about being first generation and about not giving up. And I told her, you can't give up now. You have to understand the expandability of intelligence. You have to understand. And so 4-page email, she wrote me back one line. She goes, Ed, I meant I'm going home for Thanksgiving. To come back to school. And I was so over. And she wrote me when she graduated from college, and she's now a teacher in Othello, and it's been years. So over the years, Stan, there are students that, like with you, that will write and stay in conversation. And it's that conversation. And we can say that we're busy. All of us that are in leadership positions that can say that we're busy, we're not that busy. We're not so busy that we can't have a 30-minute conversation month after month after month, for as long as the student is willing to have conversation. The quid pro quo for me, Stan, is the only thing I ask the students to do is come and find a time to visit, and we can go for a walk, we can do whatever. But it's not me benefiting them. It's me asking them, tell me what the campus experience is like for you, not the masses. Tell me how you read these emails that come from administrators. Tell me if they make sense. Tell me if our Be Boundless campaign makes sense. Tell me if students actually read emails from administrators. Tell me what the experience is like for students from where you're living, mm-hmm. and whether you're living in an apartment, and just talk to me about that. And students will tell me, you know, those banners you have hanging around, they don't seem very authentic. And when you send branded messages, I delete them. When the pandemic started, the most important thing that I heard from students was, because we were trying to figure out how to get students to wear masks, how to bring students back to campus. Students, we had a committee, and there were a couple of students that sat down and said, you know, we don't read emails from presidents and deans anymore. We delete them. If anybody's going to get students to wear masks, it's going to be other students. We are influencers of each other. So let students talk to each other, figure out how to enable us to talk to each other. Send us masks, then get out of the way. It was revelatory for me to hear sending formal messages of students from whatever your title is doesn't really impress students. But the extent to which you can make a connection with them and understand how they read their experience, that stuff is going to matter. So it's better for the university. It's better for me, Stan, if students reach out and say, you got 20 minutes? Let's talk about issue X. You also know this, Stan. We have this way of thinking about brilliance, and I think oftentimes we think about it wrong. We think about it in terms of test scores and how people do in school. Our students are brilliant for who they are. And it's hard to imagine that in 17 years of life, some of these kids come up with remarkable things that they want to do and ways in which they want to imagine the world. And when you get out of their way, they come up with things like the Dream Project. They come up with things like Dog Days. They come up with things like, you know, student athletes traveling around the country and around the world. It's amazing when we get out of their way, but listening to them matters in creating space, and we do have time. So it's good for the university, it's good for us, and good for all of us.
Well, it's really an important message that I want our listeners to hear. They may not believe us, but they need to try some of these things. If they try it once, they may be surprised to see how exciting the outcomes could be. Is there any last word? I mean,
well, you know, I'll add a final thing, Stan, because you know this. There, I don't know how many clubs and organizations there are on campus. And there's something that every student has imagined, but they come from students saying, we don't have a yoga club. We should start a yoga club. Right. And there is a yoga club. We don't have a cycling club. We don't have a skateboarding. We don't have a math club. That when students come and want to start something, especially at big public institutions, there is always something that you can start and always an idea that you can seed, and there will be support for that. So
it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Edward. This has been a treat for me. There's some aspects of your story that, even though we know one another for a really long time, I didn't know you were from, your family was from New York, which is where I'm from. At some point, we need to explore that similarity. So again, thank you so much for taking the time. I know this is the time of the school quarter that is a busy period. You know, students are getting ready to wrap it up for the quarter. And I hope you and your family have a wonderful holiday. And we'll see one another very soon, I hope.
See each other soon, Stan. Tell your family, because I see in your little signature there, it says Julie Stein. Tell Julie hello. Yeah. And
yes.
Tell your family hello.
Will do.
Thank you, Stan, for the honor of carrying on the work that you do.
Thank you, Ed. Next time when we get together, I want to talk to you about something that I think is on the minds of almost all students and their families and others in their lives who are helping them to pay for college. As I said on the very first day of this podcast, college is expensive. And I believe that there are ways that you can reduce the cost of it, of your education, eliminate the cost of your education. And next week, we're going to dive into some of the strange and arcane things that you can do in order to get an enormous number of dollars to pay for your education. And we'll also talk a little bit about the really big things that you can do. The whole concept of, do I qualify for a Rhodes Scholarship? Some of those types of things, I believe you do qualify, and we'll explore those things next time.
Extracurricular in particular.
A podcast from Dr. Stan Chernikov. Thank you for listening to this installment. Please check back for new episodes. And as always, subscribe, rate, and review so we can be popular with the algorithms. Produced by Matthew Chernikov, Dr. Stan Chernikov's son. Deepfake Talkbot co-host provided by Fake You. Until next time, extracurricular in particular. Over and out.